I just wondered if you could talk about your understanding of segregation in the Dayton area and like sort of very broadly defined what effects it's had and what your research has been focused on. Maybe first, why are you interested in this question of segregation in Dayton, residential segregation? Massey.
Massey and Denton. He was on, he was an outside reviewer for my dissertation. So residential segregation is a core concept in sociology and urban sociology. So we teach about it, it's in all our textbooks, and we know that it's a strong predictor of lots of other things. So in Dayton, I've lived there. I'm originally from Kentucky, but I grew up most of my life in Montgomery County. I now live in Greene, but I've always worked in Montgomery County. And around age 19, I started volunteering with the homeless and the poor at Dayton. Always have, to do a lot of work on poverty in the county and for the city. And I used to work on the west side of Dayton. I did homeless policy planning. I would help homeless folks maintain housing. And I, while in college, I did that work for quite some time. So it's always been an interest. As an undergrad, I did an urban sociology class where I studied the Wright brother, Wright Dunbar neighborhood. I actually did a paper on gentrification. My master's thesis was on suburban homeless in the Miami Valley, and that is a phenomenon. So it's pretty much been what I've done for a really long time. And in its core, it's a core subject of sociology.
Wow. I don't know if you're. You would be comfortable sharing me that, sharing with me those papers that you've done.
So the master's thesis is available online. That was through Wright State, and it's on suburban homeless, and that was done in a while ago, let's see, 89.
Yeah.
You can find that through OhioLINK.
Wow.
The other one was back in the day when you typed papers. I kept it after all these years.
Yeah.
I would have to make copies for you,
Yeah.
but I do have that paper. I had a student at Wright State a few years ago who was one of my former students. He went back and looked at that neighborhood and used my paper. But it was definitely, it's old, it's yellow, but I can make copies. If it was my niece, it'd be an email, and I can make you copies of that.
That would be amazing,
So,
yeah.
yeah, that the river desegregation of Dayton is always an interest. It's a, you know, when we talk a lot about hyper-segregation and sociology and the aftermath, and now you've got all this new work on opportunity mapping. So segregation creates concentrated poverty and neighborhoods with less opportunities, and you really see it on the west side of Dayton. Like the long-term aftermath of residential segregation in Montgomery County and for Dayton is we've left people behind, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So they're living in neighborhoods with less opportunities than families in suburban neighborhoods.
Yeah. How did this come to be? What do you see as the nexus between you know, this old dichotomy, when people talk about segregation, there's like these countervailing sort of arguments. It's like, oh, well, people choose to live separately versus the policy versus sort of market things.
Yeah, so as a sociologist, I took a lot of history classes too, and my understanding of the history of this area, and that's an area where I've sat through a couple courses, but a lot of segregation in the Rust Belt, right, in the Rust Belt cities came from the Great Migration. So in the beginning, when Southern African Americans moved up north, the greatest migration our country's ever seen, they were forced to live in segregated neighborhoods, right? So historically, it wasn't by choice. And then we know the practices of redlining in the, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s didn't help with that. And now you're left with people on the west side of Dayton who have homes that are so devalued that moving becomes really problematic. And it's also home. I mean, we had a meeting the other day in Dayton when we were talking about this. There's some new research. I can't cite the studies, but I've been looking at it. There was a study done a while ago, like if you take urban African Americans out of their poor neighborhoods and put them in suburbs, will they do better? So the original research said no, they don't. overwhelming neighborhoods and put them in neighborhoods with better opportunity that they do better. But for me, then what happens is you get people saying, well, they should just move. And I don't think that's the solution. I think we need to do something to help stabilize neighborhoods in our county. So there's also a lot of good writing on neighborhood stabilization and what that would look like. And I think the problem that people in the suburbs miss, or at the county level, that you don't want a dead city. A dead, unhealthy city is not good for the suburbs. And, you know, I think sometimes that's not a connection people make.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the aftermath has been, you know, we have neighborhoods of low opportunity, on destabilized neighborhoods with high crime. The schools are struggling. And you know this. I mean, it's just left.
Sure.
I like the term hyper segregation. Left behind a group of people that struggle reaching the so-called American dream because they live in communities that have fewer opportunities. They don't even have, there's a walkability index for Dayton. It's not a walkable neighborhood. There aren't good parks for kids to play in. There's no good grocery stores. The schools are struggling. So, and we've left behind people when we did this.
Yeah.
Suburbanization. And I think some of it, you know, was obviously white flight. We know that. And then some of it's just also been sort of natural. And then we also know that because of redlining, a lot of urban African Americans couldn't move out. They weren't allowed the same opportunities in the suburbs that other people were.
Right. Right. So, sorry, I'm just gathering my notes here.
Oh, no, no problem.
I'm wondering in your research, if you've found that, that there are particular reasons that suburbanites will cite as being the reasons that they don't want to have low-income housing in their neighborhoods, sort of like historically, and maybe like what the rationale behind their arguments are.
Yeah, so there's a lot of studies on that too. Again, I can't cite one, but I know there's quite a few. So what I've read and when I teach urban ethnicity courses and we talk about it. I mean, bottom line is there's this concern that it'll affect property values, right?
Right.
I think that's the number one reason why people say, but then there's also, you know, concern about crime because supposedly low-income neighborhoods come with crime. And then, you know, my guess is there's also some racism involved, right? We know that. We know that we live in a racialized society. So I'm sure that's part of it as well. There have been communities. I live in Xenia, and I live in a pretty upper-middle-class neighborhood, or maybe, yeah, upper-middle-class, but we have two low-income housing projects in our neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
So some communities didn't have that fear. So we do have two housing projects, and those kids do really well. They're integrated. And
mm-hmm.
One of the elementary schools in the area, we've seen a big difference in what it does for kids, you know.
Yeah.
Not live in an area of concentrated poverty, so.
Right. Let's see. Are there any specific sort of like, if we're speaking structurally, are there any specific like policies and things that have either been complicit or have been like the leading force in creating urban segregation, suburbanization, disinvestment, things like this? Can you point to any specific like federal, state, or local policies in the case of Dayton?
I mean, zoning laws have played a pretty big role in some of this. So the zoning of neighborhoods and inner cities and the way they're zoned is a big problem. I know that I've been to a couple meetings on just changing the zoning. the fact that the city, and this is, I don't know if it's the city's fault, but what we do with absentee landlords is a serious problem in most urban areas. We have all these absentee landlords who don't take over the property and it's not enforced. Where yeah. in suburbs, you would see that very much enforced.
Yeah.
And then I would say in recent years, the whole issue of, you know, the housing crisis and the amount of money that was loaned to people in poverty. And then we had all these foreclosed properties. I think, I forget that statistic. Dayton was one of the highest cities with foreclosed properties. And then not investing in your urban neighborhoods, cities, especially in the Rust Belt, just sort of de-invested from that. Federally, I shouldn't think of state and federal. Well, some other things that happened too were some of your insurance companies, I know Nationwide had a huge discrimination lawsuit. So they also wouldn't insure families living in poor neighborhoods. There was redlining with loans, but then later we've had insurance companies, homeowners insurance, would not give insurance to families living in certain neighborhoods, in particular concentrated poverty neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
I know there's some other ones, but I'm drawing a blank on some of them right now.
Sure, yeah, maybe.
We have quite a few.
I wonder if your locus is all, has been on this question of the subprime crisis. And, like, why that might have. Because I know it's really funny because the worst hit cities, some of them, like, all. Very, very many of them were in Ohio. Also, Ohio has, like, the highest rates of segregation in their cities. Like, Cleveland is number one in both of those categories.
Yeah.
And Dayton is not far behind. Like Massey says, Dayton in 1989 is the third... By 1989 is the third most segregated city in the nation. What do you think it is about the Rust Belt and like these sort of issues that end up happening? Is there a nexus of like the economy and the social landscape that's particular to the Rust Belt, that's particular to Ohio? Or is
also, I would say, I mean, if you look at residential Rust Belt, and the top 20 cities are often in the Rust Belt. Part of it is, unfortunately, the move from an industrial economy to a service economy. So what happened to all these Rust Belt areas, they were doing pretty well. Even the west side of Dayton, even though it was segregated, people were able to get factory jobs with a high school degree. I remember when the last crisis happened, I had factory workers who lost their jobs at GM, and they were at Sinclair. You know, I teach at community college during the day. They were at Sinclair taking classes, and one guy raised his hand and said, even if I get a two-year degree from here, I'll never make the money I used to make for GM. So part of it is the aftermath of a major economic shift in our area. So we were, in many ways, we know it's not a good thing for a city. Cities should be diversified economically. But when you look at Ohio in particular, we were very dependent on, especially the automobile industry, probably number one. But, you know, well, actually it's number one because it was automobile, it was tire companies. So when all that went away, you've left people with houses that, first of all, the whole housing market in Dayton has devalued, the whole Miami Valley area. So even me, I live in Xenia, but my house is worth about $60,000 less than what I paid for it.
Wow.
So I can't move. I can't move or sell my house, right? I'm going to lose money.
Wow.
So you're looking at a whole area where selling your house would mean you probably lose money. Now, there's a few, right, wealthy neighborhoods where that didn't happen, but in general, people are looking at homes that either didn't increase in value. So that's a big thing, too. When you're younger, you buy a house and you hope that it's going to increase in value. It's sort of the American dream that you make a little money when you retire. But that's not happening anymore. So I think it's, first of all, just a changing phase of the economy. And now we've got a service economy. And I mean, I could take it culturally, too. In the United States, we have this thing about home ownership. And as you know, socialist countries and in general, a lot of countries, you don't own a home, right?
Yeah.
You rent a flat for life, but this home ownership is definitely part of the American dream, and in my opinion, it was partly supported because we had an economy that could support that, but now that we're, you know, predominantly a service economy, it might be, I don't know, but it might be that our wages don't support the culture of home ownership anymore. I think that's something to think about, too, when I travel abroad and, you know, most of my friends living in other countries don't own a home, they rent.
Yeah.
So I think we have growing pains, too. I, you know, if you look at average living wage and what's happened to it, it may be that home ownership is not something that's going to be part of our culture in the future. I don't know.
Do you know, most of my peers that I talk to, and these are well-educated people, who have, you know, the best opportunities out there, are not interested in buying a home. They want to rent in a city, and maybe this is just being in your 20s, and that's very possible. But it seems like I'm not sure, but generationally, it seems like maybe there's been a shift because we've seen how that, like, the housing crisis sort of went down, and it really didn't do a lot to bolster our faith in the economy or, like, the, you know, the promise of, like, taking out money and then, like, going into debt and then having faith that you'll be able to pay that debt back has sort of been, like, really shaken, especially with, like, rising tuition and stuff and the stuff that we're going
through.
So I think we're less likely to, like, jump to take out a massive mortgage and stuff because of, like, the ways that the economic realities have changed. And we've seen, like, our parents go through foreclosures and, you know, stuff like this. So it's like...
But I think generationally also, I mean, because of the shifting economy, finding a job that you're going to have for life is not happening anymore, you know? And so you need to be mobile.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, I've been thinking about it culturally, if we're not going to see a shift in homeownership in this country.
Yeah.
Where you need to be mobile. I mean, owning a home makes you less mobile. And with the changing nature of economy, I mean, you can move to a city and have a really good job, and then that, I'm talking about National Cash Register in Dayton.
Yeah.
They moved to Atlanta, so all these people moved here, bought homes, and then, you know, I think National Cash Register helped people relocate.
Yeah.
But I don't think they got the value for their home.
No.
So I think we might be seeing a shift in that, and I don't know what that means. You know, I don't know what that means for segregation. Thought about that too. Will we see segregated apartments? My guess is maybe.
Yeah.
And what does all that mean? But I think people increasingly have to be mobile, and homeownership prevents that in some way.
Yeah.
But we'll see.
Well, you know.
Yeah.
Sorry.
That's
okay. Sorry. Did you want to finish?
No, that's okay.
I just got really excited because I'm thinking. Have you read The Making of Ferguson by Rothstein?
Yeah. I read an excerpt, but I haven't read it yet.
Okay, yeah, it's great. So this was really exciting for me reading this because basically you have federal housing dollars in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s going towards underwriting loans that banks would give to suburban builders who, and these builders had covenants that said only white people can move into these places because we want our properties to retain the highest value possible, right? So what this meant was that you had a pouring out of the white people from the city to the suburbs. Black people stay behind largely in the Rust Belt to continue to rent or to buy up properties now that are worth much less than the stuff in the suburbs. It's a racial exclusion to begin with, but then 1968 rolls around, Fair Housing Act says you can't do that. So now there's no racial, like, barrier per se, but there is an economic barrier because in the intervening years, like, the suburbs have built up this equity. At the beginning, like, someone who is employed at GM, who was black or white, was making a relatively comparable wage. So not at all on par, but compared to today and, like, the amount of wealth that African Americans have versus white people. So they were on better footing and may have been able to, black people would have been able to afford these houses in the 1940s, just as well as white people. But by 1968, when the racial exclusion is gone, so much equity and wealth has been built in the suburbs that you have an economic barrier. So,
yeah,
So and then you get to the point today where African-American income is 60% of white income. African-American wealth is 6%, 6% of white wealth in this country. Largely, in Rothstein's view, because of the exclusion from the housing market and the exclusion from the ability to gainfully make equitable their housing and stuff. So I wonder what this means. If we're moving away from a homeowning society, then where is the wealth going to be generated, and how do we think then about making more on part? Do we continue to invest in fair housing and say that this is important because it's the bedrock of wealth for American people and Black people should not be excluded from this? Or is that a fool's errand if we are moving away from...
Yeah, I don't know. I'm sure it'll be... I don't think it's going to be as important as it used to be. That's just more of a futuristic perspective, but I think it'll always still be there. You know, there are people that, have small business owners who are committed to their community, so I guess this homeownership will always be there. I just don't think it will be at the levels that we've seen. And yeah. I don't know what that's going to mean, because it has been a very important way people build wealth. But in recent years, houses are not worth what they used to be. So I've lived in my home now for 20 years, and so far I have no wealth from it. In fact, it's more of a money. What I put into it and if I ever had to buy to sell it tomorrow, I would actually lose money.
Yeah.
So in the United States, we always think things are going to get better. Housing's going to go up. Everything's going to get better. A lot of costs have gone up, but not housing.
Yeah.
Cost of everything's gone up, but not housing. So it's very fascinating, and it'll be interesting to see what it does. There are larger numbers of people of color moving to the suburbs. It's the urban underclass that got left behind. And what does that mean? I think it's a great, great project that you're doing. It's going to be...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, well, and could I ask you a question? Firstly, I wondered if you knew anything about sort of, the donut theory and everything like this. Like the donut version of suburbanization, where you have first tier suburbs and now second tier suburbs. Ferguson is a second tier suburb now, where you have people of color moving in to those places. And then the other thing was also, I'm thinking about different neighborhoods and different suburbs to focus on. And then finally, I know that we're sensitive to time at the moment because you're probably out of your car now. So
I'm actually stopped at a gas station. I was finding driving and talking wasn't a good thing, so I
great.
Stopped at the gas station a little bit.
Well, I'm really interested, considering you've done work in the Dayton area. I'm looking for a case of a... Did I say this already? Maybe I said this already. That I was looking for a neighborhood in Dayton, probably on the west side, and then a suburb, either the Fairborn area or the Kettering area, probably, in the 675 corridor, that may have experienced things like urban renewal and the subset of urban renewal, like highways and slum clearance and things like this. And maybe the movement of manufacturing out to the suburbs. I'm thinking the GM plant in the Kettering area.
That area of Kettering would be good, yeah.
You think it would be?
I do. I think Kettering would be interesting because you did have some manufacturing move to Kettering.
Yeah.
Another city or suburb you might want to take a look at, because it's the least segregated in the Miami Valley, cheaper heights.
Really?
Yeah, you might want to look at that data, and that's an interesting mix. It's a pretty mixed suburb, so it might end up helping you make a comparison somewhere.
Great.
The problem with Fairborn and or Beaver Creek is you also get the military base.
Yes.
So, and I don't know how that, if that's something you want in your data or not. You end up getting, Beaver Creek basically has no people of color living in it. I looked at the statistic the other day, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Fairborn has more. And then Fairborn, as you may know, was not, it was two cities that combined.
Osborne and Fairfield or something?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know what that, there's a whole history of that. I don't know what that would maybe possibly do to your data, but your study. I think Kettering, of course, is good. I would encourage you just to look at Huber Heights and what's happening there, because I think it may not fit whatever model you're thinking of. I don't know for sure.
Yeah. No, that's important. I mean, you know, the thing with history is that we're materialists, so there's got to be the, you can have as many theoretical frameworks as you like, and you, of course, you come to it with a bias, but you need to see what's there. So, but I think that having a sort of a theory can guide your, like, flashlight, as it were, you know? So that is really important, actually. It seems like I could look at Huber versus Kettering. What's the difference? Yeah.
Yeah, it might be interesting.
Yeah.
I just happened to look at, I was looking at segregation. I was teaching about segregation. I was looking at that data again the other day, and I just think I don't know enough about Huber Heights. I don't know the history, but I find it really interesting. And I don't know how it became. It's pretty mixed, and I don't know the story of that, but it would be interesting to know.
Oh, totally. Yeah, I should look into that. And then also on in terms of neighborhoods within Dayton itself, I've been looking at some documents from the 60s that talk about the amount of, like, demolition that goes on in different areas. I've been looking at Roosevelt as well as Carillon as two prospective neighborhoods that might have really been affected by urban renewal and sort of depopulation and things like this in the 1960s, 50s.
Roosevelt's a good one, I think.
Yeah.
Because at one point Roosevelt was, it had so much to offer.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, too. I mean, early on, segregated African American communities actually thrived, and there were, we know that it increased individual businesses. There were a lot of, you know, black-owned businesses. There were, it actually at some point had some good, you know, some positives that were part of that, too.
Yeah.
And then increasing with suburbanization, we saw that loss. Well, so there used to be a lot of black-owned businesses in Roosevelt and Carillon as well, especially in the Wright Dunbar neighborhood, too.
I'm sorry, which neighborhood does that fall into? Is that its own?
Wright Dunbar is its own neighborhood.
Okay.
It's right across the river.
Yeah.
It's right across the river, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's still struggling as well. It's a aviation. It's a National Heritage Aviation Park now, so they've been trying to revitalize that neighborhood.
I think I went with Lewis Wallace of WYSO to West Dayton to meet this organization called Neighborhoods Over Politics, and they took us around. They were really keen to, in their words, give us a tour of West Dayton and to see the amount of disinvestment that has occurred there. And I believe we did go through that little corridor. There's like a small downtown.
You did. Yeah, there's a small downtown. They're really trying to come back. And they've been trying for a long time. Because that's the neighborhood I studied, I don't know how many years ago, 20-something years ago. So.
Well, Catherine, I'd be so interested to see your work on
sure,
these places.
Sure, it was old. We'll see. I don't remember
well,
what I wrote.
Well, that's great, because I'm a history major.
Well, it's yellow. I'm sure there's typos too. There was no computer in that day. I can't believe I'm that old now. So
no,
I went white out left and right. So
no,
I don't
know
why I kept that paper. I just did because I kept hoping that neighborhood would get better, and it has a little bit, but not what I thought it would back in 20 years ago. I thought it would get much better, but it didn't.
Yeah. And I would also love to sit down with you maybe over some coffee in January.
Sounds great.
If you're interested, and
yeah, I would love to hear more about what you're doing. So I appreciate hearing the history more. I've heard it a few times, but just we kind of talk about the history, but then we focus on current just because we're trying to solve a problem right now.
They're linked.
What we do.
They're definitely linked. So it's I really enjoy taking sort of a multidisciplinary approach. So So thank you so much for your work that you're doing.
Feel free to email me with any questions or follow-up questions too. That will be fine.
thank you so much, and I look forward to getting in touch with you when I'm back.
Okay.